I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're recording on today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I extend my respect to their elders past, present and emerging, and any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander listeners that we have joining us. Sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
I was standing right next to him and my mother was standing on the other side. I was on his left-hand side, Mum was on his right-hand side, so much so that every time he moved, I could feel him bumping me. He's got the gun and, you know, and then the police came in and I'm sure that everyone has seen that on the television and knows it was worse inside than it was on the outside, and it was just insane.
Louisa Hope may not be a name that you're instantly familiar with, but what you will remember are photos of Louisa being stretchered away from the scene of the Lindt Cafe siege in 2014. I think many Australians will remember where they were when news broke that a group of people were being held hostage in the Martin Place Cafe across from 7 News. I'm going to leave the details for Louisa to share. Louisa is an incredibly inspiring and, as her last name would suggest, hopeful human. She spent 3 months in hospital with multiple surgeries for gunshot wounds before creating the Louisa Hope Fund for nurses. As many of you listening know, I have a background in journalism, so these sorts of conversations are truly a career highlight. It was such a privilege and honour to speak to Louisa. We discuss faith and religion, trauma, community, and the Lindt Cafe siege in detail. This is my chat with Louisa Hope. This is Life Chats, deep and meaningful conversations with friends and strangers. Louisa, thank you for having me in your home.
Thank you.
And welcome to Life Chats.
Thanks.
A lot of this podcast is about existentialism and faith and purpose. And I'm interested to hear, have you always been a faithful person?
Well, that's an interesting question to start with. Mm-hmm. I was raised in a Catholic tradition, mm-hmm. so very much in that vein. And of course, eventually there came a point in my life when I decided that that was not for me. Mm-hmm. And I became very devout in my atheism, actually. Mm-hmm. So I was only relatively young when that happened, but I was determined about it and resistant to anything that was vaguely religious. So it was a surprise to me to find myself when I was about 19, 20, to suddenly realizing that actually there was more than I was resisting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I found myself in faith then.
Many people would also say this to you, but your last name is Hope.
Yeah.
And from everything I've researched and read, you just seem like the most incredible, positive, hopeful person. Can you briefly just tell me a little bit about yourself and your life up until this point?
Okay then. Right. Well, now I was raised on the south coast of New South Wales, mm-hmm. on Yuin country. So we grew up going to the beach and beach home and church, you know, that was it really. And moved to Sydney, as everyone does in the 80s, which is a common experience for people who grow up in rural Australia to relocate to the closest city. Sydney was that for me, and my family was all here as well. And then I married, went to Adelaide, got divorced, discovered faith in that period, and then remarried and then returned to Sydney and, yeah, worked at a bank, and it's all pretty normal.
You were diagnosed with MS, which we briefly spoke about. I think I read that was in about 2002.
That's right, yeah.
What has your experience been like with that? Mm-hmm. How old were you at the time and how has it kind of changed your life?
Yeah, well, I was just busy at work and at home, very much involved with my community, and everything was go-go. And I kept falling over and I could not work out for the life of me, you know. And I'd fall and I'd say things like, I'm clumsy. Oh, I fell off my red high heels, you know, all that kind of thing, random things like that. But it just kept happening. So it was September of 2002. I was turning 40. and I was getting divorced and I was diagnosed with MS. So that was a very busy month, that particular month.
To go through.
Yeah. So it was all at once. So it was a moment where you sort of stop and go, oh, whoa, well, I'm paying attention now. What's really being said into my life, you know? Mm-hmm. What was your my life about, you know? That whole kind of crisis moment. Mm. And I think that it was an opportunity. MS was an opportunity for me, an opportunity to pause and reassess a lot of things and to find my way through that to a place of peace, really, in my heart about it. Because you don't know, you get a diagnosis like MS and you don't know how it's going to work out for you. You know, some people have the misfortune of going into illness and disability rather quickly, whereas for myself, it's taken some time for that to roll on. But you don't know that in the moment. Yeah. So,
do you feel that your diagnosis may have strengthened your faith, or you kind of leaned into that a little bit more during that time, or that's been unwavering throughout your life, do you think?
I think that, you know, from the time that I came to a place where actually I believe that there's more than just what we can physically see, I think that from there on in, my faith was always sure in my heart. Mm-hmm. And so even when things are bad, faith is still real. No, it's not just for the good times. It's for the bad times also. But it's like it's not, oh, I turn on my faith now because I've got this sort of crisis in my life. It's not like that. It's just this perpetual underlying core belief or reality in your life. So, you know, it's, not something you turn on and off.
No, I can relate to that because I'm a very spiritual person and I find that it's just a knowing. Like mm-hmm. I can't really define what religion I would fit into or if I even am religious, but it is a knowing that's kind of just underpins your life.
That's really interesting, Georgia, because I would say that's exactly how I feel.
That's religious.
And whilst I am a Christian and I love Jesus, but the truth of it is I would never describe myself as religious, because religion and religious things is really about our performance and how we perform. We do X ritual and Y ritual and we behave in a certain way and that gets God on side. But I don't feel that it's really like that. I feel that it is more core than that.
You described before that you're the type of person that has had lots of interesting moments in your life, forks in the road. Do you believe in sliding doors?
It's so funny you use that expression, because when I talk about the siege, for example, when I speak about it publicly, I refer to sliding door moments, of which there were several in the cafe. You know, a sliding door moment, for example, my mother and I had stayed at the Hilton the night before and we literally got up in the morning and we had an appointment up in town to visit a lawyer that happened to be in the same building as the Lint. And we had that moment where we went, will we have breakfast at the Hilton or will we go up to the Lint Cafe and just have coffee and toast? And we had that moment, we had a little discussion, Mum and I, and we just went, we just want a light breakfast, we'll go up to the Lint. And we just sort of slid through that door. Mm-hmm. You know, things could be so different with just a wink of an eye.
Totally. So let's go to that day. It's mm-hmm. Monday, 15th of December, 2014. You're in the cafe. It's just a regular morning for you. You're having a day out in the city, getting some things done. At what point did you kind of realize that something wasn't right?
Well, we'd been there for a little while, Mum and I, and we were far too early for our appointment upstairs. And so we decided, again, a sliding door moment, that we just have another coffee rather than go upstairs and wait in their reception. So we had another coffee, ordered another coffee, and we were just sitting there and there was a little buzz that went around the cafe. You know, the doors are locked. And I said to Mum, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, they'll just get the building manager, they'll sort that out. I'll just go and pay for our breakfast. So I went and paid for our breakfast that day. And yes, that was when we realized that something was amiss. And it was only minutes after that, I'm standing at the cashier actually, when he stood up and was making his proclamations and telling us what was going on.
You've described, I think in previous interviews, your mother was a very strong and stoic woman. Mm. and she had a bit of a sense that something wasn't right. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell me a little bit about that and her sense of intuition on that morning?
Yeah, definitely. So just for explanation, my mother was sitting on the bench seat looking out into the cafe, and I was sitting on the individual chair looking directly at her. So Mum and I are chatting, and she's saying things like, "What's that man over there? Who's he?" And I'm going, "What man?" And she's going, "Oh, there's a man over there. And what's he doing?" And she just constantly was talking about this man and how he looked a bit out of place. And I'm going, "Oh, shush, Mum, don't worry. Just, you know, have your coffee." And but she kept coming back to this conversation about this man, and she was looking at him. And, you know, and then at one stage she was talking about him, and she said, "You just know what, I don't know what he's doing over there." And I literally turned around and she said, "Don't turn around now." You know, those kind of moments you have where you're talking about somebody and don't look now. Anyway, it was a bit like that. But she was definitely onto it, you know. It was her intuition, definitely. She knew. And of course, would I say to you that if I had followed her intuition, we would have got up and walked out of the cafe because some strange man looked a bit funny to my mother? Mm. Probably not, you know. We don't follow those instinctual things, do we, really? But she definitely had it that day. And of course, you know, there are moments in your life when you really should listen to your mother, and that was one of them. However, there we were.
Do you find that that has impacted your sense of intuition now in life? Do you try and kind of tune into that a little bit more? Or because I do find some people are more intuitive than others, or perhaps more connected to it. Has that changed your behavior in any way?
I think that it certainly has made me perhaps more willing. You know, it's really easy. Intuition is one of those things that I believe we all have because it comes from our gut and our deep spirit. However, we've been told forever that we have to concentrate and look at things logically and sensibly. And actually, that was a part of my experience in the cafe that day. But, you know, we definitely turn off our intuition. We do it deliberately, in that we dismiss ourselves and others, which perhaps isn't always the best.
No. So if we fast forward a little bit, it becomes clear what's happening. Mm-hmm. The doors are locked. You're in there together with, I think, 18 people. Is it correct?
That's
right. With you being one of them. You made multiple 000 calls, I believe, during the day.
Yes.
Can you recall the first one and what was said?
Yes, I do remember. I thought that I was making the first 000 call, not understanding that Tori had actually gone before me. And so my 000 call, I thought, got to make the most of this. So I remember very particularly saying to the operator, "Now, are you listening? This is really serious." And they're going, "Yes," you know. And their way of doing things is, you know, fire, police, ambulance, that's their question. So trying to get over that and just say, "No, you have to listen. This is really quite different this time." So I remember that, trying to have that conversation. So they're all about trying to get information out of you. And at the same time, I've got a man with a gun and supposedly a bomb who's saying to me, "Just say this," and just, you know, he's on top of me virtually. Well, not literally, but he was, you know, onto it. And then, of course, when we hung up we didn't hang up the phone. He said to me, put the phone down, put the phone down. And I deliberately put the phone back down on the table, but left the line open, hoping that that might give them something, you know, an idea of what's going on in the cafe. I don't think it was any use to them. But anyway, there we go.
In the first hour or so, can you also recall any of your sort of interactions with these strangers that had been having breakfast or working in that first hour, kind of starting to talk to them or look at them? Were you able to talk to anyone? I guess I'm interested to hear about how you kind of transitioned from being strangers to now you're in this together.
Yeah, well, you know, the gunman very much had control over all of that, literally everything. Mm-hmm. He was saying things to us like, "Don't talk to each other. Don't look, eyes closed, eyes open." He separated my mother and I, for example, so that we couldn't communicate together. And he kept everybody as separate as he possibly could and not communicating together. So it took a little while for everyone to kind of get the feeling for each other. The staff in the cafe had the advantage in that they knew each other. Mm. But of course, we didn't know. We're just all, like you said, random strangers.
And I think he took, from what I've read, kind of not a liking to you, but he seemed to kind of want to use you as, he used you as a shield physically, mm-hmm. but also he used you as a kind of a prop to speak to the outside world. How did you feel in the moment? Did you feel that made you safer or perhaps more of a target?
I think, Georgia, the whole day was about managing his mood or trying to manage him as he thought he was managing us. So just trying to work out exactly what he wanted, whether he wanted strong and assertive or hesitant and humbled, you know. So just trying to keep on the down low with him and trying to keep my mother on the down low. That was an experience in itself. But, you know, really just trying to work out what he wanted and what he needed and give him what he needed to keep him from not killing us, as he kept threatening all day. And as we were waiting for the police to come, we thought. So, you know, it was that kind of, there was a lot of transaction going on, just trying to keep him pacified and get him the media attention that he really wanted.
And is that what you thought in the moment, that I suppose you thought you were going to die, but you also thought the police were going to come and save you? Was that kind of the narrative the whole time, that we're going to be okay because we're across the road from Channel 7 News?
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, it never occurred to me, I have to say. It just never occurred to me that the police weren't coming. So jumping ahead to the inquest and then hearing that the police had no actual direct action plan to come and rescue us was gobsmacking. Of course, it kept us going during the day because we were all focused around trying to get him the media attention that he wanted. However, it certainly points to the fact that those who managed to escape, really, they were very smart. It was the smartest thing to do. Yeah, I just assumed the police were going to come.
We will touch on the inquest a little bit later on because I am interested to hear your thoughts on that now. But speaking of escapes, did you ever think in the moment or try and scheme an escape for yourself and your mother? Or you thought, we're in this? Because I know there were multiple times throughout the day where little handfuls of people escaped. For you, was that something that you were interested in trying?
Because of his overarching threat, and especially when the first people escaped, the three men, when they first escaped, and we all thought, as he thought, that the police were coming in, and it took the quick wit of Jared Morton Hoffman to say, no, no, the police aren't coming, they have escaped, which totally changed the whole situation. He made it very clear that if anyone else escaped, he would kill one of us. So, you know, when a man has a gun and the bomb, you know, that was a very real threat. And the idea that if we attempted an escape, that someone else who may still be inside would be killed was just too much to think about. You know, really that just was, so therefore it wasn't part of, it certainly wasn't part of my thinking because the consequences of it were too dire.
Too real.
Yeah.
Sure. This is a moment that we spoke about off camera, like this is a moment that kind of captured the nation and you say that it belongs to the nation. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will know where they were.
Yes.
When this was happening. I was sitting in my lounge room with my mum. We watched it live all day and all night. We stayed up until the end.
Thank you.
Oh, of course, it's one of those moments that time stands still, doesn't it?
Yes.
But I guess on the outside world, we knew what was happening, or at least we had basic details. In that cafe, what did you think the state of Sydney, where did you think that this was going? Did you think there were multiple bombs and this was a huge nationwide terrorist attack? I suppose, what information were you getting during the day?
Yeah, sorry, Georgia. Yeah, he was listening to the news coming through on people's phones and things like that. And so we were getting news from the outside. And of course, there was the news about all the bombs around the city. And at first he had us engaged with trying to talk to the police about the fact that there were other brothers, as he called them, and bombs all over the city. And as the news came out that the city had been cleared and there was no bombs found, and it was kind of like, okay, then, you know, ticking off the checklist, you know, there's no bombs found anywhere else. So where else are the bombs and who else is involved? Is there anyone else involved? The whole thing started to become smaller and smaller and just us in the cafe, which in actual fact it was, you see. So, yes, it went from being massive and all over the city to being just us in the cafe. It was really interesting how that happened.
I can only imagine. And I think I heard you interviewed, you said that there was one moment where he was demanding that a car be moved, for example, outside. And in the time that it took for you guys to request that, and that actually happened, I think it was 4 to 5 hours. But in the interview, you said that it happened quite quickly. So What was time like during the day?
Yeah, this is a thing. You know, I lost complete track of time. My mother has had like some sort of internal clock where she could tell you what time it was and not even know. You look at the clock, it's a bizarre thing with her. But anyway, I had no sense. I lost total sense. Of course, you know, it was summertime. And so when it went dark, I went, oh, well, it must be about, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock now. But apart from that, I had no idea. I completely lost that.
Can you talk a little bit about interactions that happened throughout the day? Any that come to mind where you may have spoken to someone who was there, or perhaps phone calls were made to family? Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, well, definitely. And I must tell you about young Fiona Maher. And when I say young, we must remember that most of those Lint workers were in their late teens, very early 20s. They're all, a lot of them at uni, you know, and this was their summer holiday working job. And Fiona was 19 at the time. Anyway, so he had had us all place our phones on the table and in sight and all that kind of thing. But Fiona, as it turned out, had stuck her phone in her apron pocket.
Very brave.
Oh, yes, that young woman. So Fiona had, I think it was her second shift at Lint. Mm-hmm. She'd only just started working there. And he'd started to send us to the bathroom. Thank goodness for bathroom breaks, with a Lint worker. And by that stage, he was using mostly Jared and Fiona to do that. So he told, I said, I want to go to the bathroom. And he sent me with Fiona, which was good. He had realized that I had a walking stick and had kicked it out of the way from away from me. So I didn't have my walking stick. So it was good that Fiona went with me because I'm a little bit dodgy on my feet.
Did he think that you were going to use the walking stick as a weapon? Or
maybe. Mm. Actually, it was a funny thing, Georgia. When he kicked that walking stick away from me, he looked directly at me and he said, you know, sorry, like that.
Wow.
And I went, sure, I understand. You know, it's just so weird when you think about that he was aware that he'd taken my walking stick and he was sorry about that.
Mm.
But hey, you understand, don't you, that, you know, of course I understood. Yeah. So anyway, off we go, Fiona and I, to the bathroom, and I'm down there and I said to Fiona, first of all, she said to me, I've got my mobile phone. Do you want to ring anyone? And I'm like, oh, well, of course, I don't know about you, Georgia, but I can't remember anybody's phone number. My goodness. So I know, Fiona, I can't ring anyone. I don't know anyone's number. And then I just said to Fiona, do you pray, Fiona? And she said, no, I don't really. And I said, that's okay. I pray enough for both of us. I'm praying, Fiona. Mm. Okay, you know, and off we went back up and joined the rest of them. But it was just those little moments when we could get away and go to the bathroom and get a little bit of respite in a way and have an opportunity to talk to each other. I can tell you a moment that my mother went to the bathroom, if you like. So my mother, Robin is her name, actually. So Robin stands up and hands on her hips and says to the gunman, I want to go to the bathroom and my daughter needs her medication. So that's another story, medication. So she goes off to the bathroom and Jared and Fiona are told to take Robin to the bathroom. So she's in the bathroom and this is a story that Jared told me. Mum never told me this. Jared told me. So they're down there in the bathroom and my mother says, right, you two.
Right.
when we go back up, what's going to happen is I'm going to walk up to him and I'm going to spit in his face and all of the rest of you fellas can all just run out the door, okay? And young Jared says, no, Robin, no, you can't do that. He'll kill you. And she says, I'm not worried. I've had a great life. I don't care if he kills me. I'm okay. I know where I'm going. And I'm thinking to myself as he's telling me this story, oh my God, that was my ultimate fear that she'd do something like that. So Jared keeps talking to her, no, Robin, don't. And then he says, but Robin, he might kill someone else. So of course, with her very smart idea, she had no smart answer for that. And he talked her down from this, I'm going to spit in his face routine. But just, I was in hospital actually when he told me that story and he's laughing and I'm laughing and inside I'm going, oh my glory, that was my real fear that my mother would do something insane like that.
It is a long period of time to be in there, 17 hours with no idea about when it's going to end and the outcome. Were there any moments of confrontation from other people throughout the day?
No, everyone was very sound and reasonable. And reason, yes. I should say. You know, the first lot of men got out and then the two younger women got out, and that was the quickest experience. He didn't realize that they had escaped, and I didn't see them go because they crawled on their hands, you know, on their bellies, effectively, around a giant cutout Lindt Cafe Christmas teddy bear. Mm. And they managed to get out the door without him knowing. But something, you could tell something had happened. And what was that something? It took me a little while to work out we're missing some people. And he was saying things like, in response to the regular media telling us that five people had escaped from the cafe, whereas as far as he was concerned, and as far as we kept affirming in the cafe, no, only three people escaped. So the truth was, and the media were telling the truth, there was no sensationalizing it, five people literally had escaped, but he didn't know that, and we didn't want him to know that.
So was that coming through on phones or on the banner outside of Channel 7 News, or how was he hearing this information? And I suppose, how were you placating that at the time?
Well, he was hearing it on the news, you know, every hour on the hour, people's phones, you know, he was paying attention to that. And he was saying five. So we were saying things like, you know, the media, you can't trust them. They lie all the time. They're sensationalizing. It's not true. Only the three guys have got. So we were just rolling with the perpetual lie. Mm. But, you know, that was life and death for us, because he had told us that if anybody else escaped, he would kill us. So, you know, it was important that we maintained that charade. Obviously, he hadn't counted how many of us there were. But the one advantage, it's a funny little thing, but all of the Lindt girls, they were all petite young women with long dark hair and in their black Lindt uniforms with their chocolate-coloured aprons on. To say they, quote-unquote, all looked the same, they looked so similar. And he just missed the fact that two were missing. Thank goodness, really.
So you mentioned that the energy kind of changed in the cafe, and I suppose it's getting darker, it's becoming evening, you're probably now wondering when this is coming to an end. I suppose, what were those final few hours like? Did you know that it was coming to a crisis point, or it was coming to the end of the hostage situation? And did Manmonis, the gunman, know that as well?
No, I cannot imagine the mind of a gunman or a terrorist, but, you know, like what his end game plan was, who would really know? In the earlier hours, I could suggest, I could say that I vibed. How would I know, really? But just that he perhaps was thinking that he was somehow going to get the big noted attention that he wanted, and that he'd somehow walk out some sort of hero for letting all the hostages go, maybe. Then there was a period through the cafe that I felt that I could see him calculating, talking, working out, almost assessing who he would release and who he might keep or kill. Which was a little bit unnerving, but, you know, that was the reality of
how was he doing that?
Just by subtly asking questions like who's got children and blah, blah. And, you know, he was shocked, for example, that mum and I were mother and daughter, and that made everything a little bit different somehow. And just sort of working out how, who had children and where everybody was placed and that kind of thing. And, you know, establishing right at the very beginning, really, you know, the two girls that were pregnant. And so there was lots of discussion and coming and going in conversation with him. So, yes, that was sort of a different kind of a thing. But, you know, just the journey through those 17 hours, obviously very long, as you said, but really... you know, there's an internal journey as well as the actual facts of the events of what was happening. And I found that, you know, for me, observing that in my own self, I remember at one stage thinking, I was aware that I had this deep-seated, deep in my gut sense of everything's going to be okay. You know, whether I lived or I died that day, I was going to be okay. And I guess that's the reality of faith. And then in my heart, I was just a scrambled mess of, oh my goodness, our family, you know, what's going to happen? And these kids and this one and that one, and are they going to be okay? And how's he going to work this out? And where are the police? And all those kind of churning thoughts. But then in my mind, my logical mind was, well, let's look at this sensibly and okay, we're all going to die. Mm-hmm. That was my only sensible, logical conclusion from the way things were going. So it just sort of was, there was the facts of the day and then there was like the internal dialogue, which I suppose every individual would have had.
I'm sure it was such a journey and you would have felt many emotions and had many reflections throughout the day. Because a lot of people talk about, you know, having these near-death experiences, whether it be accidents or something like what you've been through. In the moment, what are you thinking about? Are you thinking about things that you wish you did differently or people that you love? Or is there anything in your mind that stands out that was a front of mind throughout the day?
So for myself personally, I had three moments where I absolutely thought I was going to, this is it, going to die. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to tell you?
Please do.
Okay. So the first time was when the first lot of hostages ran out mm-hmm. and he grabbed me, thinking that the police were coming. And I also thought the police were coming, but they had run out, the people had escaped. But in that moment, I thought, right, this is it. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to die now for sure. Either he's going to kill me or the police are going to kill me as they try and kill him, because I was so close, literally, virtually head to head there. And I thought, okay, I can't die having any ill will towards this man. I can't die with hate in my heart. So I thought, okay, if I've got hate in my heart right now, I just pray forgiveness and help me to be ready to go to God. So there was that moment. And then, of course, once he realized that they had escaped and the police weren't coming, everything calmed down. It was just like, okay, second chance here. So there was that moment. And then the next moment was when a large group of the others had escaped right at the very end, this was. And I got up to go and escape. I thought, right, we're leaving now. I had been in a moment of intense prayer with my eyes closed because the gunman was getting anxious about noises in the cafe, and he decided to go investigate them by himself with three other people, which was Jared, Fiona, and another girl called Selena. So he's on his way towards the kitchen to investigate noises. And he says, okay, Jared, you mind the door. He tells Jared to actually mind the door. Like Jared, I don't know what he thought Jared would do. And so he then walks to the kitchen with two of the women. And I thought, oh my God, what's he going to do? Is he going to kill them or is he going to do something worse to them? What is he going to do with those two women in the kitchen? And so I just went, oh God. So I close my eyes and I'm praying away like a mad woman. You're like an absolute crazy cow. God, are you watching? Are you hearing this? Are you seeing what's happening? You know, it was pretty intense. And then I had my eyes closed and then bang, big noise. And then I opened my eyes and all my fellow hostages had escaped. So I got up to go as well. But my mother and Tori Johnson were still sitting. They weren't moving. I'm trying to catch their eye. It was dark in the cafe. Didn't know where the gunman was. So I'm ready to run out and I'm thinking, I can't leave my mother. And I literally spun around on one foot and then decided that I can't leave mum. So I decided to lay down on the floor. Then literally he was over the top of me. But in those few seconds, it was seconds, I had that moment where I thought, okay, he's definitely going to kill me now. I'm dead. Are you ready for me, God? I'm going to die right now. Mm. And I don't know that my life flashed in front of me, but I remember thinking, you absolutely have to live your life to the full whack because there's no time for regret. I'm thinking that thought and thinking at the same time, here I come, God, you know, and imagining, okay, what's it going to be like? I don't know, but it's coming. And then he didn't kill me. He grabbed me and he grabbed me through my bra strap and back of my dress and dragged me up. And I'm, you know, a bit unsteady on my feet at the best of times. And then suddenly, you know, I was involved in his panic and his, you know, what he wanted to do, what was he going to do next? And that's when he, you know, positioned mum and I on either side of him and the amazing Tori Johnson, he made kneel down. So there was that time. And then, right at the very end, when the police were coming and the gunfire did not stop, it just kept going. And I've spoken about that many times, but the thing I remember, of course, you know, the internal dialogue was, we survived this whole day but I'm actually going to die now because the gunfire didn't stop. It was so intense. So I thought to myself, oh, well, I'm going to die. I might as well watch. So I took my hands. I covered my eyes with my hands. I took my hands away and opened my eyes. Wow. I could barely see anything because it was smoke and everything in the room from the gunfire. And I just watched, which to say, what did I watch? I couldn't see anything. But the fact that the gunfire kept going, I figured they haven't caught him yet. So, you know, those moments of thinking I'm going to die.
Thank you for sharing. In those moments, were you aware of where your mum was? Or obviously you thought this was coming to an end, whether you were coming out alive or not, you assumed not. But did you know where your mum was? Did you know if you were on the ground standing?
I was standing right next to him and my mother was standing on the other side. I was on his left-hand side. Mum was on his right-hand side. So much so that every time he moved, I could feel him bumping me. He's got the gun and, you know, and then the police came in, and I'm sure that everyone has seen that on the television and knows it was worse inside than it was on the outside. And it was just insane. And I remember standing next to him and thinking to myself, okay, just stand still and the police will shoot around you. Which is really stupid. But anyway, there you go. That's what I thought in the moment. And the next thing I know, I'm standing up next to him and then somehow I'm on the ground. And that's about 10 seconds, I think. And for the life of me, I don't know how that happened. And I don't know how I got onto the floor, but there I was. I found myself on the floor, not far from where I was originally sitting. And it's all going on all around me. And when I'd opened my eyes, I'd looked down and I saw my my feet, and I had on my very favourite red high heel sandals.
Typical. Favourite shoes.
Yeah, that's right. They were. Mm. And I thought, oh no, the straps on my sandals are missing. They're broken. How am I going to get that fixed? Doesn't matter, I'm going to die. How am I going to get that fixed? You know, your mind does all sorts of strange things in those circumstances. So I'm worrying about my shoes and thinking I'm going to die, and it's all happening all around. And you just sort of think, where am I? Is this real? You know, just, is it real?
I think I read that you were the last person to come out alive of the group that were, that hadn't previously escaped. And it was 3 months, I believe, in hospital recovering, not only from the shot to your foot, but also shrapnel to your abdomen, which I think a doctor explained that having a bit of fat may have saved your life.
Yes.
Her words, not mine. But talk me through those first days. I suppose, were you consuming the media and kind of seeing what the world had seen? Were you speaking to other people that had been in the situation, or were you focused on just getting through your immediate surgeries and your recovery?
Yeah. The thing I remember about hospital is, well, so much, of course, but I remember when I was on the, they placed me on Phillip Street. The two TOU guys carried me out in the end. But just overwhelming gratitude, like not just, oh, I'm so grateful. It was just more than that. It was like a flood of gratitude that I hadn't died, because I, you know, my logical mind was telling me that I was going to, but the overwhelming sense of gratitude. And then, of course, it quickly became about, well, where's mum? Because once again, you know, if you looked at it sensibly, you'd think no one could have possibly survived what we went through. And so I'm sort of yelling out to the police at that moment, where's my mum? Does anyone know where my mother is? And then at one stage, one of the police came over to me and she said, do you want your mother? I'm like, no, where is my mother? She was in there with me, you know. And so eventually, you know, the call come back that they had my mother. We've got your mother. And I'm like, great. And then the next thing is, well, what do you mean you've got her? What state is she in? And at that stage, I just thought that I had a wound to my foot. Actually, I really thought that I was going to lose my foot. Mm. It was kind of messy. Anyway, so mum went to RPA and I went to Prince of Wales. And being in the hospital, nurses are incredible. Obviously, they're doing their job and they're clinically experienced and they're excellent at what they do. But they also bring that other thing. And I think the other thing that they brought to me was humour and the capacity to absorb everything that I was talking about, which was stuff from the police, stuff from family, concerns, you know, everything. And I, just being able to So what I wouldn't talk about with my family, I'd talk about with them. Because, you know, some things you don't want to worry your family with, you know, especially for my family, because it was mum and me, you know, they were concerned, you know, crossing Sydney around two different hospitals. But the time in the hospital was really great. And I certainly was not paying attention to what the media were doing at that stage. People were coming in and telling me things. I do remember that friends came in and said, oh, that Tory Johnson, he's a hero. He fought the gunman. And I went, actually, no, he didn't. Mm. And then I had a little dilemma of everyone thinks that Tory is a hero, but he didn't do that. He didn't fight the gunman. Tory was a hero, actually. Tory was a hero because of the fine man that he was, but he actually chose to stay in the cafe. Tory chose to stay to look after my mother. And I didn't know that until 12 months later with a little conversation I was having with mum, just a by the way moment, mum and I. But that's the truth of Tory. And for me in the hospital, it then became pressingly obvious that we were going to have to deal with the media. And then, of course, the question became about who would we speak to. So there was a lot of prayer and talking going into that.
Hi, everyone. A quick reminder that if you are loving this chat, I would be so grateful if you could take 2 minutes now to jump on whatever platform you're listening to this and leave a review or share the episode you're currently listening to on social media. I'd love to see where you're listening from, if you're going for a walk, if you're at the gym on the treadmill, if you're driving. Obviously, don't take a photo if you're driving. But it is so incredible to see that we now have listeners from over 35 countries tuning in. And the more that we grow, the bigger guests I can bring you. I am so, so grateful that you're here on this journey with me. And I'm excited about the life chats that we have coming up with some absolutely inspiring guests. Thank you so much. Were you speaking to anyone else that had come out of the cafe as well? Were they in the hospital? Were you making contact with anyone at that time?
No. And, you know, our only way of contact was via the police. Mm. And so the police had two things in their mind, I think, as I understand. The police were obviously concerned for us because we're in hospital and every individual person reacted to what happened differently and just traumatized beyond belief, which is understandable. And others like myself and mum, and of course, poor Katrina, she passed, and her family, and Tory had been murdered. And so there were lots of things going, churning amongst the people who had been involved. And mum and I, really all we wanted to do was have contact with everybody to check and see if they're okay. You know, especially mum, she really wanted to know what was happening for everyone. But the police were thinking two things, I think, as protecting each of us in some ways, everybody even wanted to see or speak to each other, but also they needed to protect the integrity of evidence. So that, of course, is very valid, but it was also really hard.
What was the mental recovery like? Because it's, say we put a 3-month/potentially lifelong recovery physically. Mm. You were speaking about how you get regular physiotherapy and you have trouble with access and walking as well. But what has the mental recovery been like for you personally?
Well, you know, the truth of it is, Georgia, that after the siege, I went through what I call post-trauma ecstasy.
Like an elevated mood or
yes,
a state.
Yes, very much so an elevated mood and just overwhelmed with gratitude, as I said earlier. But just that kind of moment of euphoria, really. It was like euphoria more than anything. And that stayed with me for a good 18 months, I would say. So our circumstance was that my sister came up from the South Coast to look after my mother and I because both of us had surgery and we needed looking after, both physically, you know. So she came up to look after us. So the three of us were living in my mother's home together, which was a lovely time for us, but also, you know, very challenging as well. So, and of course, I took a bit long to recover physically. So the idea that mum and I were recovering in a different way, it took a long time for my brother and sister and I to realise that things were different for mum than they were for me. So I was in a euphoric state, which stayed with me, I think, probably for a good 18 months, a bit longer. And then, of course, I was involved with a lot of fundraising and speaking for the hospital because, you know, we started the Louisa Hope Fund for nurses at the Prince of Wales mm-hmm. as a thank you and gratitude towards the nurses for what they'd done, you know, because I was just so determined beyond anything else. And I remember on Phillip Street, you know, when I was lying there, I'm not dead. I knew at that stage that Tory, you know, didn't know about Katrina, but I just thought we have got to get something good out of what happened, that, you know, we can't be defeated by this. So starting the fund was a lot about that. Definitely thank you, but also about saying we can get something good out of what's happened here. And so, you know, for me, that's what it was like. And so here we are 8 years, and probably about 12 months ago, 18 months ago, I was in a bit of pain and I went to a pain specialist and went with a lot of cynicism, I have to say. But anyway, the pain specialist said a whole lot of things and this and that. But one of the things he said to me was, at the end of the session, he said, now we have to talk about your PTSD. And I said to him, oh, no, I don't have PTSD. I'm fine. I'm really good. Everything's, you know. And he said, no. And I said, I'm definitely not depressed. I never felt depressed. I feel sad about it. I feel grief, but not depressed, you know. And I'm thinking that he's just a little bit OTT, you know. But anyway, he sent me to a psychologist, and the persuasion was in the end that this particular psychologist had been working with veterans. And I thought, okay, well, if she works with veterans, she must have an idea about, you know, wounds and, yeah, that sort of scenario at the end of the cafe. So anyway, I went along to see her, and eventually we started to do EMDR. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I've done EMDR. Oh. Yeah, so it's very transformative.
It is.
I think a lot of people don't know about it, but one of my podcast episodes, I actually interview my own therapist.
Ah.
And she speaks about how EMDR was basically created for war veterans because talk therapy was so re-traumatizing for them to have to just recount what they'd been through. But yes, did you find it helpful for you?
Well, blow me down if it sure was. You know, it's astounding.
Yeah, it's
amazing. If you've gone through it too, you would know. It's incredible that it actually works.
It's one of those things that, for me personally, I thought, that's just woo-woo. I'm going to sit there and someone's going to go like this and I'm going to look and then I'm going to be cured.
I know, right?
But it seems to somehow work.
It does. And that's the, I absolutely was one of those moments where I thought, wow, this is real. It's actually working. So from not believing that I had PTSD, because, you know, PTSD, you imagine, is something that war veterans come home with, right?
I think that's the misconception, is that if you haven't been through a war, therefore you're not worthy or valid of having trauma. Whereas we can be traumatized in small ways and our body often holds on to that, even if logically I feel similar to you in a sense that I would say I'm fine and I'm very high functioning and I'm a positive person. But I think your body does remember what you've been through. Right.
And, you know, this is a thing, Georgia, and the EMDR experience has reminded me of the fact that, you know, when I was in that cafe with the gunman, he was equally polite, well-mannered, considerate. At the same time, the very same man was going to kill us, was threatening, was holding, was manipulating us. It was obvious, you know, and all of this kind of thing. And you think, what kind of man does that? Well, that kind of man, you know, that duplicitous, double-minded man. He's concerned, for example, about my MS. Really? In the middle of holding a sausage, you're worried about me having MS? You know, it was only been like half an hour earlier, he was holding your gun to my head, going to kill me.
Or pulling you up by your bra
strap.
That's
right, exactly. So same man, right? So who is that kind of man? Well, we know those kind of men. We know those kind of people. The man who bashes his wife and then tells her that he loves her. We know that kind of man. They exist in our life. Now, obviously not all people who are guilty of domestic violence go on to terrorist action. But, you know, there's no way that we can imagine that that man's any different to us ordinary people.
It's incredible that you have the awareness and the strength to have sort of curiosity around his personality and kind of the behavior and where that's come from. Because I imagine a lot of people would hold a lot of resentment and fear and anger around what they went through. I do want to get to the Louisa Hope Fund, which you mentioned, which is incredible. The fact that you put I think, $25,000 from your 60 Minutes interview straight into that fund to start it. Can you just reflect on what sort of work they're doing and kind of what inspired you? I know you said that the care from the nurses was a big thing, but what else?
You know, originally my thought was I just wanted to say a small thank you to the nurses. And I thought, okay, well, you know, church, friends and all that kind of thing. We'll do a whip round, we'll have a little fundraiser or something. And, you know, if I get about $5,000, that'd be great. And, you know, if they want to buy a coffee machine and a popcorn maker for the staff room, I'm fine with that. You know, something small on the ward. But the fund really took legs when, you know, I was discussing with the producer of 60 Minutes. There was a lot of talk about various other survivors having big contracts with television. And there's a lot of discussion in the public about money and all that kind of thing. And I really was not wanting to get involved with that. But this producer said that he would give me $25,000 for my nurses fund idea, which I'd been talking about, you know, that kind of thing. And I went to the CEO of the foundation at Prince of Wales Hospital. And I'm holding on to, well, by then it was $50,000 because Mike Baird very kindly met that 25. And I'm saying, so I've got this little bundle of money, but I don't want it to go to paint in the boardroom or carpet or anything like that. I want it to go to the nurses. Now, fortunately for me, Lulu Zalapa actually had been a nurse herself in a previous life, and she knew exactly what I was talking about. So she created the Louisa Hope Fund for Nurses and set it up so that the nurses could apply for a grant for something that they wanted, and that we would then fund it. Because, you know, in our hospitals, you know, we have a brilliant Medicare system, but on every ward in all hospitals around the country, there's certain things that the nursing staff would like that would help their patients. Mm. And so that's what the fund is for, really. And of course, nurses, they don't actually want a popcorn machine. They want things that are going to help patients, which is just amazing and says more about them than anything.
Totally. Wrapping up, do you feel comfortable to talk a little bit about the inquest before we close today?
By all means.
So I was listening to notes from the inquest, which, as you said before, just as harrowing to probably relive and find out new details for you than living through that moment on the day. But I think there were over 44 recommendations from New South Wales State Coroner, Michael Barnes, on how the situation could have been handled differently.
Yes.
There were things like the fact that the snipers could have taken the gunmen down earlier throughout the day. I suppose for you being there, how do you think it could have played out differently?
Yeah. You know, I think that we all need to remember that the New South Wales Police, who copped the biggest hit, you know, they have done incredible work since the siege to change their procedures and their processes and a whole lot of different things that come out of the recommendations. And I think they are to be commended for that. They are operational things which were necessary and not easy, but were easy for an organisation like the police to attend to. And I'm grateful for that. And for the ongoing leadership that will continually have our police updating the way things are done, not only here in New South Wales, but around the country. What happened at the Lynch has made a difference to operational issues all over the place. But of course, the thing is, it wasn't just the police for whom we should look to. Our institutions, for example, we perhaps could look to the DPP for some changes there. The DPP, the way they chose to behave at the inquest was most discouraging, I found. It was discouraging from the point of view of they chose to, as much as possible, not reveal any details of the dealings that they had with the gunman and why he was even on bail in the first place. Deeply disappointing. There's work to be done there. And perhaps in the future, there will be somebody in the leadership of the DPP who's prepared to go down that track. Of course, there were many things that were done. My experience, we don't realise it, but, you know, the media actually became players on that day. Mm. They were players because what they were saying on the outside was impacting directly on us in the room. So myself personally, I would like to see a moment, and I've been told that this is impossible, but I would like there to be some way in a live action where the police and the media could somehow agree to perhaps not publish, not discuss. There are times when it's necessary for media to be involved. But, you know, when it comes down to my life or your right to know, I choose the right to live of the person who might be involved.
What were some of the moments in the inquest that really took you by surprise, or I suppose details that just completely shocked you that you didn't know up until that moment?
Yeah. The most shocking moment at the inquest was the one and only day that my mother decided to come to the inquest with me, because I went every day or nearly every
and was
day.
It, sorry to interrupt, 18 months? Is that how long the
yes,
inquest
it
took?
Was. Mm. It's a long time. It's like getting up and going to work every day. But anyway, we all knew that we would have to give evidence. And it was becoming increasingly obvious to my family that Mum was in no fit state to do that. And, you know, she was very challenged both physically and emotionally. It was increasingly becoming obvious. But she decided that she was going to have to give evidence so that she would go and just to see what it was like. And it happened to be the day when they started the section on the police. And that particular session, counsel assisting, was laying out some facts about, you know, the police involvement. And one of the things that he said was that at no time did the police have a direct action plan to come and rescue us. So, of course, that was gobsmackingly astounding. I remember the break for morning tea came at the inquest and everyone stands up and bows to, you know, the coroner as he walks out the door. And Mum and I were just sitting there, actually, and everyone had left. And Mum says, I can't believe they weren't going to come and rescue us, Louisa. I thought they were going to come and rescue us. And I remember saying to Mum, I can't believe it either. We just had that little moment. And especially for my mother, but it's almost like it just changed her whole view of what that whole day was like. And it's, she never really did recover from that. And I think that it was so shocking, because I think most people who were watching, who were outside, were thinking the police were going to come.
Especially after 17 hours, I personally remember thinking, like, what is taking them so long? What is going on? Just go in there. And that started to be the sentiment on social media, and and news reporters were saying that as well, I suppose, not knowing what was going on behind the scenes. But just could you quickly clarify, you mentioned deliberate action plan. People listening might not know what that means in relation to an emergency action plan.
Well, a deliberate action plan is when the police make a plan. So all day, it has to be said, the TOU, so the gentlemen, the guys who came in.
The tactical
operations. Yeah, the tactical operations guys, the guys at the end in the all black and the balaclavas and the big guns, and those guys were constantly all day, as it turned out, putting up plans to the leadership of the police. It's saying, we can do it this way. We can, you know, we've got a plan. We can go in and rescue them this way. And there were several times throughout the day when they were putting up those plans. However, they were knocked back by the leadership. So that's a direct action plan. So they were submitting them, but they were being knocked back. An emergency action is when all hell breaks loose and they've got no choice other than to
which
is what happened in the end.
Yes.
That's an emergency action. So that's what happened in the end. And, you know, always, I suppose, will be the question, if they had been able to go in deliberately under the plan that they wanted to use, could things have been different? And, you know, you don't know, sliding door moment again, I suppose. I guess the leadership had other things they were trying to consider. They were concerned that there was a bomb. The two reviews that were done of the Australian Lindt Cafe siege by Scotland Yard and also the General Police in Britain were that in normal circumstances, in Europe, for example, if there's a threat of a bomb, the police go in as soon as possible. Whereas in Australia, there was a threat of the bomb and the leadership were keeping the TOU back. So, you know, that's a lesson learned.
Yeah, we could definitely discuss this, a lot of politics around the situation. But before we go, I'm interested to hear, you've been back to the Lindt Cafe. You obviously have daily reminders with your pain and your mobility that this is something that you've been through. Other than that, how has your life changed and how have you moved forward?
You know, I've always believed in living a purpose-driven life. That's a mantra that's not uncommon amongst Christian people. And so living your life deliberately, you know, deliberately on purpose, choosing kindness, choosing love, you know, so that's one of the staples of my life forever, well, since Faith. And so therefore this circumstance comes along and you think, do things change? Well, no, actually they don't. That doesn't change. So those things are still core to my belief and hopefully my life practice. And I don't always practice as well as I could, but I hope and I try. So in that way, nothing's changed. But then circumstances of my life have changed and things change, you know, like I wouldn't have randomly imagined that I'd be sitting here having a chat to you, for example.
8 years later.
That's right. Mm-hmm. You know, and so all of those things. So I've had lots of wonderful opportunities. It is the people I have met, you know, like not wanting to name drop, but the fact of the matter is I've met Oprah, for goodness sake.
It's incredible.
I know, right? Like, isn't that just the weirdest thing? You watch that amazing, luminous woman on television and then you come across her. And so, you know, that's what's happened. So therefore now I hope that I would live my life with that intention to, you know, what is the most loving thing to do in all circumstances? So that's that I hope remains. The other thing that having been in the siege has actually given me and gifted me is the opportunity to make a difference and to perhaps influence for a difference. So that's a privilege. Yeah, I don't walk so good, right? And I'm a bit wobbly and, you know, there's a whole lot of things, but I am so privileged. So blessing, right?
Totally. Very inspiring. We have a closing tradition on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Every single guest is asked the same question at the end. You can answer in as little or as many words as you like. Louisa, the question is, what is the meaning of life?
So the meaning of life, I would say, is, oh gosh, so cliched, but it's love, right? Mm-hmm. It's the ability to choose love. And I do believe it's a choice. So I think the meaning of life is love. Oh, I wish I had something brilliant.
No one has said that yet. So thank you. I just want to take this moment to say this has been an absolute privilege for me to sit down with you. I'm very, very grateful we're in your home. You've opened up your home for us. You've been generous with your time and obviously recounting details that are distressing and quite hard to go through again, I imagine. So thank you for inspiring. Thank you for taking on this amazing role that you have in the community and in the media as well. I think a lot of young people listening will take a lot out of this. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Georgia.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Please let me know who you'd love to hear from next, or if you have a story to share, I'd love to get in touch with you. You can connect directly with me on Instagram at Life Chats Podcast, one word. And every review and share really does help so much in the early days of building a podcast. So if you've enjoyed this conversation, please share it on social media, or you can snap a pic of where you might be listening and jump onto Apple Podcasts and give us a review. I really do appreciate the support more than you know. Have a beautiful morning, afternoon, or evening wherever you may be listening in the world. I'm Georgia May, and this is Life Chats.